Greetings to you, wherever you may be listening to Albert Camus Radio. Today we're going to be doing a book review of a recently released text that I think a lot of the population of this podcast will be very interested in reading. It's Albert Camus Speaking Out, Lectures and Speeches, 1937 to 1958. It's a vintage international publication of 2022, and the speeches and lectures contained in this volume have been translated by Quentin Hoher, and it is a welcomed addition to the English reading world of Camus studies, and those of us that read French and English, it's certainly nice to have these collected speeches in English for a little bit easier access for folks like myself. This primary work usually takes place in the English and then moves out to the French for the finer points. So we have a nice collection of 34 lectures and speeches written by Camus. Not all of these were given by Camus. There's a certain number of these speeches and lectures that Camus gave face-to-face to an audience. A certain number of these lectures were written and given by a proxy. They were mailed to somebody to speak on his behalf and read the words that Camus wrote. And there are a certain number of these that were never given but were recorded. So this is a very nice collection because it gives us a really solid tour of his work, 37 to 58, and you can see the transition. I'm particularly thrilled that it goes back as far as 1937 because he certainly was in demand as a speaker later on in his life after publication of The Stranger and The Plague, certainly, and with the crisis in Algeria. But you get an early look at Camus' work as it develops. You get a look at his intellectual development as we go forward. There's some really interesting observations that I've certainly made by reading and studying this text. He makes no references to any of his fictional characters in here. That's very interesting to me. I'm not sure if this was a desire not to call attention to his commercial works. So when he was speaking on these issues, all of which are very serious issues, he didn't want to sound like he was pitching his books. That's possible. I think that's probably in my mind, the number one reason why he's not referencing any of his fictional characters. It also may be the desire to keep his audience locked in on what he's saying. And if he references out to characters in The Stranger or The Plague, he may fear losing some people in the train of thought and in the argument that he's constructing, maybe lost with the reference there. And also maybe a little bit of humility or lack of self esteem as a professional writer, that he may assume that not many people have read his works, which I guess he would have the data in front of him that lots of people have, but he may just not want to make that assumption that a lot of people have read his works and they can immediately conjure up Marceau or Dr. Rieu or other characters from his work, but they're not mentioned in here. He sticks strictly to the topic. Some of the speeches are occasional speeches, which means he's been asked to speak on a particular topic to a particular audience. And those are always very well focused. And then others are some impromptu responses. I found the impromptu responses to also be very illuminating of Camus. It actually changed my view of him a little bit. It added to the picture of how I have seen Camus as a thinker and a person over the years. I will leave it up to the reader of this text to make their own conclusions, certainly about this, but I don't think he was very adept at arguing on his feet. The impromptu passages, and I'll read one later in this podcast, he struggles certainly to make clear points and to argue coherently at times, which makes me think of an awful lot of things. Number one, his deep engagement with Sartre and de Beauvoir in the cafes, where that was the sport of the day, certainly was tackling these topics and being able to have this intellectual exchange and hold your own and be able to not leave the debate 2 hours later and on the walk home think, oh, that would, I should have said this or should have said that or etc. That's surprising to me, and maybe it's just I just have some anecdotal evidence here. It certainly could be the case that he was in front of a crowd, maybe in front of a large crowd. That's not fair to judge Camus' ability to think on his feet or think quickly or form an argument quickly in that. But there are some passages that are particularly puzzling from his engagement, sort of one-on-one in an impromptu way. So the very first speech that's included in this collection strikes me as a very important speech. It's the title of it that Camus gave it is Indigenous Culture, the New Mediterranean Culture. And it's possibly because I found my new academic home in a setting that takes Indigenous studies extraordinarily seriously. And I think the level at which Bemidji State University concerns themselves with the Indigenous studies should be mirrored across the United States. It's I could see that a lot of other institutions are insulated from taking this topic as serious as they do. So when I saw that the first piece in the collection was about Indigenous culture, and it's written in 1937 and delivered in 1937, it's also of particular interest. So 1937 is when Camus is leaving the Communist Party, and we don't know exactly the narrative, how that formally happened. Camus argues that he quit, and the Communist Party, the French Algerian Communist Party, makes the case that they threw him out. Probably both happened simultaneously. And Camus left the French Algerian Party for very good reasons, in my opinion. He left because they had to make a decision. Was the French Communist Algerian, was the French Algerian Communist Party going to support workers' rights for indigenous population or just the French colonists? And they came down on the side of, if we're going to get anything done, we cannot support the Arab population. It will involve us too deeply in domestic politics in Algeria. It'll separate us from some of our hardcore support in France. So we're just going to go for the French, the Pierre Noir population in Algeria and support them, and possibly circle back and look at Arab rights, indigenous folks later. And Camus would have none of it. If you're not going to support everybody in Algeria with this political movement of communism in 1935, 36, 37, he was going to have none of it. So he left over that issue. That's the hot button issue. So you're seeing this, you're reading this speech in 1937, which is a very important period of time in Camus' political formulation and thinking about his status as a colonizing person in Algeria. He's only 22 years old when this is written. So again, factor that in to the intellectual development of this person when you're reading this speech that Camus gave in 1937. It shows his early formulation of where he's going to go with this terrible issue that's going to confront him his whole life in Algeria. I'm going to just read a very short passage from this 1937 speech, which will show us some of his movement towards some more important patterns of thought of Camus that arise later. I quote Camus here. This is from page 7 of this collection. Quote, it is not the taste for argument and abstraction to which we lay claim in the Mediterranean, but its life, the courtyards, the cypresses, the strings of peppers, etc., end quote. So he's already becoming critical of system thinking. He's already becoming critical of system thinking that sacrifices today for the next, that moves into the abstraction from the concrete. You're seeing that with this very nice piece in 1937. You can almost read into it this forthcoming criticism of Marxism, because he's thinking very deeply about Marxism during this period of time. And you can also see that the wheels are probably turning about Christianity, which we're going to get in the Rebel later works, where he really fleshes out this particular criticism of the modern world. The later stuff, the war period and right after the war, is taken up with one of Camus' sort of real formal thoughts, this coherency that he has about the crisis of man. So he reflects very deeply upon the World War II experience, all aspects of it, and formulates this ongoing theme about the crisis of man. And he does a really nice job of articulating it in the speech or lecture, which is titled The Crisis of Man. So I'm going to read again a quote from Camus from the Crisis of Man speech here, which is included in the collection, which is a 1946 lecture that Camus wrote. And I quote, "Yes, it is an interesting generation. First and foremost, because confronted by the absurd world that its elders were creating for it, it believed in nothing and lived in rebellion. The literature of its age was rebelling against clarity, stories, and even sentences. Painting was rebelling against subjects, realities, and mere harmony. Music was rejecting melody. As for philosophy, it taught that there was no truth, only phenomena, that there might be Mr. Smith, Herr Vogel, but there could be nothing in common between these three specific phenomena," end quote. So he's really looking at this particular time and what led up to World War II, what led up to the terrible tragedies that unfolded across the globe, and particularly in Europe during that time, and looking at it from sort of an intellectual history point of view. I found another particularly interesting quote for my area of study in The Crisis of Man, which is one of the longest pieces that's included in the collection. He's talking about what we can do. So he's actually got some normative, he's got criticism, but then he follows it up with normative suggestions, which I find to be very refreshing and well done by Camus. And he addresses philosophy. So he addresses philosophy after he's criticized it in the passage that I just wrote. He circles back to give some normative advice. And the fourth, I'm quoting Camus here, "And the fourth thing to do is to seek out and create, on the basis of negation, the positive values which will permit reconciliation of negative thought with the possibilities of positive action. That is the task of philosophers," end quote, to build and to create, which I always find a critical part of philosophy. We move now into, I think the most illuminating piece you will find by Camus, when one really wants to study his connection to religion, and most importantly, his connection to Christianity. You get his famous engagement at the monastery with the unbelievers and Christians is included in this collection. And you get a really thorough understanding of Camus' delicate position vis-a-vis religion and as it connects to Christianity in particular. He has a passage, or he has a lecture that was left untitled It was a message that he wanted to have read in 1946 concerning the status of Algeria after the war had ended, and it's titled by the person that put this collection together, Mr. Hoyer, "The Knowledge is Universal," is what it's titled in here. And there's a very revealing passage in here about how he's seeing the Arab European or the French Arab relationship in Algeria during this particular time. So I'll quote Camus again. This is from page 51 of this collected works. Quote, "On the day that Europeans cease to view Arabs as picturesque, incomprehensible people, on the day that Arabs cease to confuse Europeans with the policemen who sometimes represent them, on that day, the world will be a happier place to live in," end quote. So no normative considerations for the problem in Algeria, but a very astute observation nevertheless. So some really illuminating pieces about communism, some very illuminating pieces about philosophy and the Arab situation, which I'll circle back on. But now I want to address this criticism that I leveled against Camus, in that he can be sometimes a little bit unsure of himself and a little bit off on his impromptu responses. So there's a question and answer session here, or question and response section in the text, called "I Reply," is the name of the piece in the collection. And he's having a back and forth here, and he has a series of questions about Davis, the American who gave up his nationality and went to Soviet Union at the time, and how helpful that may be for the Soviet Union, how damaging for the West that will be. So here's the question to Camus. "Don't you see that Davis is useful to Soviet imperialism?" Camus' reply to this is the same reply as to the last question. "Only in reserve, I'd add the following. Imperialism are like twins. They grow up together and they cannot do without one another." So American and Soviet, or Western and Soviet imperialism here. And the question then back to Camus is, "Don't you see that one must take such a reality into account?" And Camus comes back with this response that I've studied quite carefully, and I just can't put it together. I'm on page 72 of the text here. Camus says, "Cancer is also a reality. Yet we seek to cure it, and nobody has yet had the audacity to say that in order to cure a cancer, which is added to an excessively sanguine temperament, it's necessary to eat more and more beefsteaks. It's true that doctors have never seen themselves as church leaders holding all the truth. That's the advantage they have over our politicians." I kind of get what he's going after there, but wow, that's a weird response with a lot of loose ends floating around in there, and just not very well thought out, I didn't think. And there's a number of places where I've really had to step back and give him the benefit of the doubt and start to pull things apart and make some connections to some other things I know about Camus to really make any sense of what he's saying. And on the spot, you would not have that. So if this was a live interaction, you would not have the time. I don't think anybody's mind would be quick enough to be able to pull all these threads together that he's left unwoven and make sense of what he's saying. So for me, it certainly does show a little bit of struggling on Camus' part with the sort of impromptu speaking. We get one of the most important speeches that Camus gave. Certainly he would not put it up towards the top. I think his Nobel Prize acceptance speech is one of the finest Nobel Prize acceptance speeches that was ever given. And it's one of my favorite speeches to read of all time. And that is included in the text, so it is here. But his appeal for a civilian truce in Algeria of 1956 is included in the collection. So people that have studied a lot of Camus would have come across this, I think, a number of times and been familiar with it. It marked Camus for the rest of his life as the intellectual that should have had his act together, should have been able to speak out, and should have taken a firm stand one side or the other. And he did not. And I think the fence sitting did more damage than possibly commercial damage, let's say. The fence sitting probably did more commercial damage to Camus than taking one side or the other, saying Algeria's French. That's the way it's going to be. It's better to be French and roll in all that imperialist business about French law is better, French culture is better, French language is better, and just stood on that side of it and sacrificed Algeria, or stood on the other side and said, it is Algeria, it is Algerian, it is not French, it was colonized, it needs to break, it needs to have its own autonomy and independence, and this, you know, France needs to pull out, especially in the military bargain of that, and sort of sacrificed his French side of it. And I can see the terrible situation to find himself in, but he did the fence sitting in 1956 in this passage, which or this part of the collection, which is on 191, is where you get this if you're looking for that right away off the bat. And I'm going to read a passage from it here from page 198. So this is Camus speaking about the issue of Algeria in, it's down the line now, very far down the line from the first one in 1937 that we looked at in this collection. This is 1956, and I quote Camus, "So far as I am concerned, I have loved with passion this land in which I was born. I have drawn from her everything that I am, and within my friendship, I have never separated any of the men who live here, whatever their race." So this is a premium example of Camus' central point in this highly anticipated, highly advertised, highly energized speech that he gave in 1956 about the situation in Algeria. We do have to be very aware that Camus did not like the spotlight that came on him. It was a very different time in the 40s and 50s. Authors like Camus were superstar celebrities, and literature and philosophy combined in the works of people like Camus made them very important people. And everything that he spoke about carried a great deal of weight. We don't see that today with the way the media has evolved, but transport yourself back to the 50s. Given Camus' reputation starting in 1942 with the publication of The Stranger and emerging as an intellectual celebrity out of war-torn France with the connections to Algeria, the spotlight is on him to lead with this question of Algeria, lead with the question of nuclear arms, lead with the question of the status of communism, lead with the question of colonialism. And he simply doesn't. The pressure is great. The pressure is tremendous on Camus. And he really feels that as it goes forward. I'm going to read a passage here that helps illuminate that particular aspect of Camus' life. So this is from page 252 on the pressure that he feels after receiving the Nobel Prize. I quote Camus, "The additional influence which has just been attached to my name by the Free Academy of a free country, it will be easier for me to accept it in the knowledge that I can place it at your service." That's a wonderful end quote. That's a wonderful passage by Camus, because he simultaneously understands the prestige of the prize that he accepted, but he also sees the pressure, and he is going to put it into service. So he understands that going forward, after the Nobel Prize was granted, the responsibility that comes with that prize, that he will have to put it into human service. Another very illuminating part of this text is that we see that Camus is very concerned with the youth. As you move on from 1947, after that, you see that he rejects an awful lot of invitations, and he addresses it a number of times in several speeches that he's turned down a lot of opportunities to speak. But he will not turn down opportunities to speak to the youth because he feels a responsibility for shaping the future. And he takes that responsibility very seriously. So a fair number of the later speeches are to youth delegations or addressed to the youth. This is a fantastic edition for the English speaking world, English reading world, of Camus studies. It's 275 pages long with extensive footnotes. It's only lists for 16 USD new, of course, available through all the major book retailers, and small bookstores can certainly get this for you. So if you're working your way through Camus and you want to supplement your reading, I think it's a very fine book, because you can even, you know, move along with it. You can read the speeches that lead up to The Stranger and read The Stranger, or read The Stranger and then read the speeches that led up to that. Then you can read The Plague, read the speeches that were written during the formulation of The Plague and right after publication of that, the interperiod, and then The Fall, or anything along that would make a great addition. I'm certainly going to make heavy use of it in any course that I teach on Camus, because he's forced to be very articulate in a short period of time. And that's helpful for undergraduate students, to not have them have to work through 15 pages of Camus thought to get at the central point, where I can have them work through 4 or 5 pages and get right to what Camus wants to say here. So I highly recommend Albert Camus, Speaking Out, Lectures and Speeches, 1937 to 1958, of Vintage International Publication. Enjoy.